לשידור ישיר ממחנה רמה בברקשיירס.
כל רמה 102.3 מגישים קיץ באוויר.
רדיו כל רמה 102.3 FM.
Another edition of Parsha Talk from Rabbi Elliot Malamud in the Highland Park Conservative Temple of Kargish Nachemet, Highland Park, New Jersey, in the temple itself. And with me, my good friends, Rabbi Barry Chesler, Salma Schechter Day School of Long Island, Rabbi Jeremy Kalmanowski, Anshei Chesed, New York City. We're recording this day 184 of the captivity of the hostages. We pray for their release. And we're thinking about them, especially as Passover is coming. It is beyond excruciating to even think of the torture endured by them and their families. I was at the rally yesterday in New York City and listened to members of the hostage families. It's very painful. The whole, as much as we want to rejoice with Passover, it's a very complicated moment. Perhaps we'll have a chance to talk about it in our conversation. But this is Parshat Tazria. Normally, Tazria and Metzora are joined. This year, because of the exigencies of the calendar, we get to read each Parsha separately. What a joy. These are Parshiot that are difficult. I'm going to put them out as they're difficult. Precisely because we don't live in the context of these categories of pure and impure, of accessible, ritual accessibility, inaccessibility, and we don't think about these individuals, let's focus just a second on a character that appears here, the person who suffers from what Jacob Milgram calls the scale disease. This is
Sarah. I have that myself.
Scale disease.
Different scale, but
getting on or off the scale. It is a scale disease. So he says, in his commentary, he says that it's probably psoriasis, which according to statistics, 1 in 50 Americans suffer from.
Can the heart rate. I want to say, Elliot, that there's another factor that is very important that we sometimes overlook, and that is our commitment to finding meaning in the Torah, because it would be easy just to say, you know what, Tazria Metzora doesn't speak to us, so we'll cut out those few chapters and move on.
Yeah.
But we don't, because every year, either for 1 or 2 weeks, we have to deal with this as best we can.
Right. And so let's go into this for a second and examine this person called the Tzaraat, Adam Kiyem B'or B'saro, chapter 13, verses 2, when a person has on the skin of his body a swelling, a rash, or a discoloration, and it develops into a scaly affection. And it's interesting, with a degree of sympathy towards the person. So I'm reading this with a different kind of posture. I'm saying, everybody looks at their body from time to time or regularly. We all want to take care of our bodies. It is especially in our highly medicalized world, we're always looking at ourselves and looking at blemishes or looking at things or maybe sensing something in our the way we move or digest or the feelings that we have, the heartbeats, etc. So Adam Karov Latzmo, we'll start with that. A person is close to himself. I'm using masculine gender here. A person is close and notices and has a certain attunement to his, her body. And in this attunement to his, her body, the person notices that there is some kind of deformity or irregularity on the skin. Now that could come from a wound. It could come from many, many dozens and dozens of different things. But at some point, he's got to get hauled before a Kohen, and the Kohen has to adjudicate. And so what the first thing I want to notice about this is that there's a human interaction here. Go to verse 2, where he says, V'huva el haron ha-kohen, o el achad mi-banav ha-kohanim. So you have a skin problem. There are no dermatological associates there. You get brought before Aaron, and that already tells you that your skin eruption has dimensions that we can't identify with.
So the question that raises, though, is what is the nature of this skin ailment? Because the way the Torah describes it, it's discoloring. It's a different color. It's disfiguring. And the question is this something that is only known to the victim or the patient? And therefore, the Kohen has to be notified? Or is it something that everyone sees and the Kohen has a slightly different role? Now he's not a diagnostic thing, but a therapist, meaning providing a medical therapy for the disease.
I think we can create a number of scenarios. I would create one scenario, which is, you know, you have a married couple and let's say the man is suffering from a skin ailment, and the woman, the wife, sees that there's a discoloration on the skin and says, I think you need to get that checked out, right? That's what happens sometimes. You know, we have mirrors today. So depending on how good your mirror system is, you could see, you know, behind you or beside you, or look carefully at your face, or look carefully at other parts of your skin that you ordinarily can't see. So in the absence of mirrors, you have other people. And so,
or it's on your back, which you never see.
Therefore, you need another person to look at your back. So say you have an eruption of, I don't know, a mole, right? This is not a mole, by the way, but these are scales or some kind of bruises or some kind of scabs. And it's saying the scab or this eruption turns into something that it's not, and it becomes white and scaly. That's when you say, uh-oh. I gotta get it checked out, and the Kohen Gadol or the Kohanim, one of the Kohanim has to check you out. But I again, in the absence of a medical world or a magic, maybe there are kinds of healers. So the fact that you go to the Kohen already tells you that it is a dimension of the ritual or of the beyond your. There's a dimension of godliness here that has to happen. Well,
you know, the one thing that I'm thinking about, okay, obviously there's tiny amount of what we would consider accurate medical knowledge in the ancient world. They knew how to do certain stuff, and they knew how to make this or that kind of poultice and remedies, but there's no germ theory until the 19th century. And I just happened to, you mentioned that there's a speculation that this is psoriasis. I just Googled up as we're sitting here talking that psoriasis is actually an autoimmune response.
Yeah.
It's not an infection at all. I didn't know that. And so one of the things that I'm thinking about in this is it's got to be massively unpleasant. You are taken out of the camp. It seems like some kind of instinctive infectious disease quarantine, but maybe it's not. I don't know. But in any event, it's not pleasant to be either socially anathematized. You're called out tame. The person is called out. You have to call out as you're leaving the camp, I'm impure, I'm impure, which seems terribly mean, although the rabbis have a much lovelier interpretation that you call out tame, meaning I'm suffering, please pray for me, which is much nicer.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking about the sufferer. Do they have to tell? Because if it's on their back, it's not so big. Maybe they can get away with it. If it's under their clothes, maybe they can get away with it. But there seems to be some sort of like communal thing that you owe to other people not to sweep this under the rug. Like, why wouldn't you sweep it under the rug? Why wouldn't
well,
you?
Well, I think there's a sense of contagion.
Exactly. You need to.
If there is, because we're talking about a time and place where they don't have anything like, maybe it's an instinctive infectious disease quarantine to stop contagion. But if that's the case, it just seems to me that we're thinking about Tumah and Tahara in a medicalized way, when I think instinctively, Tumah and Tahara, the ritual impurity and ritual purification, you know, as the great anthropologist Mary Douglas said, you know, it's not dirty and clean, it's ordered and disordered. And if your skin's like bursting and erupting and acting weird, it just seems like it's life out of order, and it has to be recalibrated so it can be in order again. You know, you said, Elliot, I thought very correctly that one of the reasons that these parshiot are so foreign to us, you know, once or twice a year, I mean, much of Leviticus, you know, like, here's what you do with the protuberance over the liver. Like, really? You know, there's not really the way we think. But they, to touch sacred things, to touch sacred food, to be in the sacred place, which is what Tumah and Tahara are all about, is like creating the zone of order and perfection where life is in order. And when people have touched death and life and blood and bodily fluids and their skin is erupting, they somehow can't go into the zone of perfection. And that is very different from the way we think. B'chol kodesh lo tiga, ve'la migdash lo tavo. That's the beginning of the parasha, that a woman who's had a child, presumably because there's so much blood, can't touch the sacred stuff. She can't go to the sacred space. It doesn't mean she's bad or dirty. We're very happy when she has a child. But it does mean that life and death are a little bit out of order in that person's personhood. So that's true, I think, here too. Yeah, that's what seems to be going on to me.
I think that you know, it's a good point to kind of dwell in, which is that you know, skin, which is our boundary to the world, is going to reflect at least the order within our body. And that an eruption on the skin is going to usually reflect disorder in the body. You know, I guess dermatologists would be very attuned to that. The same way dentists, for example, can tell your whole body from your teeth. You know, they're able to see you know, and distinguish things because that's their. I mean, they're not able to diagnose. You know, who knows what? But. Everything's related to everything, and things that are on the boundary are going to reflect this. Let me put one point in front of everybody, which is that so this individual has to do the following things. He has to shave his hair. He has to tear his clothes. He has to.
I don't think it's shave hair. I think it's let your hair grow wild.
Let your hair grow wild. He has to tear clothes, and he has to go off to. Sorry.
You put this is, by the way, very interesting. I know where you're going, and I'll let you say it, and then I'll chime in.
No.
You put in a kind of a mask.
It's a mask. He has to cover something on his upper lip, and then he goes off into kind of, you know, being sequestered, okay? Which is, these are the biblically, these are mourning rites, okay? We have there's a whole extensive analysis of this, but these are the things that Aaron and his sons in last week's part, they're precisely not to do, because they're not to be engaged in public mourning, because they are the officiants of the tabernacle. They can't mourn this, you know, the high priest cannot engage in mourning. Okay. But so here's this individual who, upon discovering that he has tzaraat, he has to mess up his hair, he has to tear his clothes, he has to put something on his lip, and he has to go. He has to basically mourn. And the question then is, well, who's he mourning? And who died? And what's going on here? So the answer is, he's symbolically mourning for himself. He has experienced a ersatz death. There's a part of him that's died, or a part of him that is experiencing a kind of death mishamayim, a kind of a quasi-death, which is because, and here the theology gets quite biblical, because he's committed a sin. He's committed a sin for which there is a punishment, and this is being manifest as a punishment from God. And so he experiences this kind of death, and then he experiences a healing and a restoration and comes back into the community. And these rituals are mourning rituals, and he's mourning for him, which in a way is a fascinating idea because, you know, where I could go with it, a lot of places to go with this. One place to go with this is, you know, people today, they have, there's something I read about recently. You do a live funeral for yourself, which used to be called like a birthday party, a 90th birthday or whatever. You have all the people that you know, are going to talk about you after you're gone and say, like, why do I have to be gone? Let me hear about them when I'm alive. So you invite people over and you talk about that.
That's strange. So, you know, the Al-Sifatam Ya'ateh, you said you have to cover your upper lip, but it's not like a band over your upper lip. What it is your face, your whole face, you have to cover up to the upper lip. This fell out of use in Jewish tradition, but that's something the Talmud requires. The Talmud requires as mourning the various things we do in Shiva, and you know, you overturn the bed, and you don't wear shoes, and you don't do this, that, and the other thing. You rip your clothing, and you do what's called Atifat HaRosh, which is like this, you know,
wearing of a turban. Or
yeah, something. I think that's where Batman got the idea for himself.
So it fell out of, and if you read like the halakhic material, they say that in the Middle Ages, they say it fell out because people just laughed at us. They thought it was so weird. I actually think, I mean, and of course we don't sit Shiva the way that ancient people did. For us, I think this is often kind of bad. You know, Shiva becomes like a little cocktail party. But for them, I think Shiva was were gestures of abjection. You were falling up to pieces and covering over the face. I have a theory. I don't know if I can prove it, but I think it is the diminishment of Etzelem Elohim. Like Etzelem Elohim is gone. It's written on the human face. And so the mourners act that out by covering over the human face. And here, I don't know if I can make that fit into Mitzorah, but here too, I think in down the lane you were talking, there is a kind of intrusion of death in the form of a body that seems to be falling apart.
Nice.
So what I'd like to add, if I remember correctly, Baruch Levine in his JPS commentary on Leviticus proposes susceptible and immune for Tamei and Tahara. That when the Bible says you're Tamei, it means you're actually in some kind of danger. And that would lead, I think, to some kind of idea of contagion. And the reason why the mourner is removed from the community is because the death of his or her loved one exposes everyone else as well. Because death doesn't necessarily have the etiology that we understand, and everyone is at risk. Similarly, the newborn mother, or the newborn child of the mother is at risk when she gives birth. And, you know, something that we overlook perhaps in the 21st century, but childbirth used to be dangerous not only for the infant, but for the mother as well. And one way of looking at this is that it's the community's attempt to come to terms with things that they don't quite understand. But what they do understand is isolation and community. Definitely. And therefore, there's a structure for isolating people and then bringing them back into communion with the community.
Which is definitely true. Elliot, what you said before about, you know, or maybe one of you two guys said about the priest function as a healer. I do think that whatever else is going on, the Mitzorah ritual, which we'll read about next week, we'll read about the purification ritual, which involves this really, you know, kind of advanced thing about dipping a bird in the blood and sending the bird to fly away, symbolically carrying all the grossness away. It is a ritual that enables the return. And we can think of a number of those kind of rituals that you know, in the Torah, people did to enable somebody who was suffering to return to the normalcy.
Indeed. Okay. Let's make a hard shift from this to offer a few meditations, a few thoughts on Pesach. We're now a couple of weeks away, 2 weeks away from Pesach. I want to think about the phrase "b'chol dor v'dor." B'chol dor v'dor, especially in the context of this year's events, has a different resonance, a different valence this year. The term appears twice in the Magid part of the Haggadah, a third part, third time in the Hallel part.
Hallel part, yeah.
Okay, so our viewers and listeners will be familiar with Vihishamda Lavotenu. The prom, we raise a glass. We're talking about God's promise to us that God took us out. Shelo echad bilvad amad aleinu lechalotenu. It's not. Not only one has risen up against us, Ella she bechol dor vador om dimaleinu lechalotenu. Every generation, some have risen against us to annihilate us. V'hakadosh baruch hu matzileinu miyadam, and God has always delivered us from their hands. And the second time is bechol dor vador chayav adam lirot et atzmo ki'ilu hu yatsa mi mitzrayim. Every generation, a person has to see him, herself, as if she left Egypt. That's at the end, right after Rabban Gamliel, Pesach, Matzah, Maror. And they do function in a way as a bracket. I want to offer the following suggestion. You know, we talk sometimes about the Seder as a particular event, as is a national event, that is to say a story that's told to us. You know, I just watched yesterday Alex Edelman's HBO thing, Just for Us. And it's very clever. I recommend it. The Seder's just for us in some ways. On the other hand, it's not just for us. It has a story there that belongs to everybody. But B'chol dor v'dor, just for us, folks. It does speak to us. Add to that by saying that every time the term b'chol dor v'dor occurs in the Bible, it's always parallel to le'olam, but here it's not. And this means to me that we tell time in particular way, generational time and universal time, but in the Seder, it's only generational time. So we're telling a specific story to our generation, and we're telling a specific story to our moment now. And in our moment, we have a generation that is being facing a unique set of challenges that are painful, difficult to this generation, and that has to funnel into the Seder through the experience of October 7, the last 6 months. And I want you to reflect on any of that, or your own kind of comments or your own ideas about this.
So I would cast it in the following. I think v'amar aleinu l'chalotenu, we see ourselves in the passive role, that the enemies come to destroy us, but God is the deliverer, the savior. So our experience is somewhat removed. When we see ourselves as if we left Mitzrayim, we are participating in the act of redemption. Redemption cannot happen without us. God is, of course, necessary, but God doesn't fly solo as he does in Vehishamda. And I think it's an important point to consider, because in the passive world, that could belong to everyone. But in the active world, I think the Exodus becomes our story of leaving Egypt. And even though others take the story and adapt it to their own histories, whether personal or national, it is quintessentially, in my view at least, a Jewish story. Hmm.
Jeremy, how do you relate?
I think that I grasp the semantic and grammatical distinction you're making between the active and the passive. I think that's true. They hate us, God saves us, versus, you know, let this shape your own self-conception. But what I would say, maybe in a different vein, is that V'hisham de lavotenu v'lanu, there's always, you know, there's always anti-Semites, there's always enemies, Jews under Islam, Jews under Christendom. Sometimes they had it better, sometimes they had it worse. You know, you don't want to fall into that trap of thinking that everything in Jewish history is just one long pogrom after another. It's not true. But I think that I hear that line, in every generation they've risen up against us to destroy us, and God has come through and we are enduring, as a tremendous reassurance for, like, imagine you saying that, you know, during the Crusades, or imagine you saying that, you know, under this or that kind of very difficult strait for a Jewish community. You say, this is not a Bible story from something that happened to a bunch of people, you know, thousands of years ago. This is our ongoing story. We have found divine sustenance. It's going to be okay. I think that there's a kind of a reassurance that even our contemporary troubles link us back to this great story, which goes back to the Torah of liberation of Yitzhak Mitzrayim, so of liberation from Egypt.
So I want to just dwell on that for a second, because and as we talk about this and share thoughts about this, it's the words Vihishamda, it's hard to read it without choking up, in a sense. There's been tremendous suffering, 1,200 people murdered, killed. There have been, you know, 600 soldiers now who have been killed, you know, from Israel. And we have our consciousness and our awareness of the suffering on the other side. But here we are, you know, facing a genocidal enemy. And it's hard to find HaKadosh Baruch Hu here for many people. And the Omdim Aleinu L'Chalotenu is not over. There is a sense among many that that this war is very, very difficult, and that this war, if it doesn't end with any kind of clarity, might invite a long period of tremendous instability in the Jewish people and tremendous uncertainty even in Israel. And that is deeply, deeply worrisome. So, what I'm struggling with is, when, as we enter in the period of preparation for the Seder, is how are we going to talk about, how are we going to think about, and how are we going to convey both the eternal story of our freedom, our narrative, and how are we going to convey the tremendous difficulty that we are feeling about, you know, the present, and maintain our hope for the future. Does Omdim Aleinu Ela? Does Ela Hakadosh Baruch Hu? Does it Matzileinu Miadam? Does it work? You know.
Well, the way Jeremy read it, it seems that the Yetziat Mitzrayim, the Exodus, is the result or the consequence of the enemies coming to destroy us. That every time the enemies come to destroy us, we have a new Exodus, so to speak. And that could be very powerful and reassuring. What strikes me is that part of the problem with the current situation is that I think up until October 6th, most of us did not look at the last 50 years as if our enemies were rising up to destroy us. There is a degree of complacency in part here and part in Israel as well, I think, and that was shattered. And now we're left with this hard fact, Omed Aleinu L'Chaloteinu, that they come to destroy us. And we're struggling because the presence of God seems remote.
I think I think that is particularly American, North American response to think that the last 50 years has not been that same period. I think that lots of Israeli Jews, not always to our benefit, because they're, you know, there's both, you know, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you. And just because you're paranoid, you know, just because they're out to get you doesn't mean you're paranoid. I think lots of Israeli Jews, especially after the Second Intifada, had a strong sense. And, you know, I was a baby in the Six Day War, you know, the stories of them digging mass graves in Tel Aviv and the Yom Kippur War, and certainly the Soviets. And I think that, you know, we in America, we got it pretty good. And I think that we have less of an immediacy or intimacy with that feeling of, you know, they really Omdim Aleinu L'Chalotein. What's the worst thing that happened to Jews in the United States? Like, you know, you didn't, there was,
that's
no, that's literally the worst thing. But I mean, for most of American Jewish history, so there's some discrimination in jobs, and you couldn't get into the right colleges, and you couldn't get, the right law firms, but for the most part, we've been okay. And I think that Israelis and former Soviet Union Jews have much more of a strong sense of Omdim Aleinu L'Chalotenu.
I'm sorry to interrupt. You know, recently a member of my congregation asked me, are you going to talk about the question, do we have a future here in America? I was pretty stunned by the question, because it did reflect, you know, a tremendous sense of unease that you know, we have enemies here. There are people that they talk about destroying us. They talk about killing us. They protest against us. They inveigh hate against us. They don't like us. They live in a fantasy world somehow, and we don't see people, you know, creating militias and trying to kill Jews, God forbid. But do we have a future here? And so we're stuck in that. I'm at least, I'm reading this with, on the one hand, I'd like to have the sip of wine right now, but I'm raising the cup of wine, thanking God that has happened in the past. But I can't say this line without some serious concern about the present and the future.
I feel like, yeah. I mean, the question is, Kadosh Baruch Hu Matzilenu Mi Adam, will the Blessed Holy One always save us from their hands? Well, past performance is no guarantee of future outcome, as they say in the investment world. So it is the statement of faith that this eternal people will hang in there and endure. I just couldn't be a Jew if I didn't believe that. And that is a theological comment. But obviously, like, what did people say? I mean, I have this Haggadah somewhere that was produced in a DP camp in Pesach 46. Yeah. And it's very powerful. There's, Avadim Hayinu Lehitler beGermania. We were slaves to Hitler in Germany. And can you imagine these people in Pesach 1946, the war is just a year over, and they say, and God has always saved us from their hands. Like, what an absurdity.
Oh, and again, that's, we're in a micro moment, I don't want to make the comparison. So this is, it's folded into a whole Jewish.
Yeah, I have to take issue with that. I don't think it's an absurdity. I think that the power of a story sometimes is that you have to tell the story, and the hope is that the story will create the reality and not just be a response to the reality.
So let me read that back into Bechol Dor V'Dor V'Yigadeta. V'Yigadeta L'Mincha, which is at the end of the Haggadah there. Bechol Dor V'Dor Chayav Adam L'Rod Et Atzmo. Person has to see himself or herself in every generation. Why? Because it says you have to tell the story. Are you saying that that's how you do it?
I think that actually is the meaning of the Seder. The Seder, which has a text, which is the Haggadah, the telling, is about a story of transformation. And the act of telling the story is what affects the transformation. We sit at the table on Monday night and Tuesday night in a couple weeks, and we should be different people at the end of each Seder. We should not be quite the same, because the story that we tell has to change us, because that is the story of our people.
Jeremy,
So first of all, what you just said is very, powerful and affecting and inspiring. When I said it was an absurdity, what I meant was the experience of the imagined, I'm just imagining, the camp survivor who is sitting there in the DP camps now and says that God always saves us from our enemies. I'm feeling that person in 1946 can't get those words out. And there may be words that we can't get out this year. But I firmly agree with you that the point of religion, or a point of religion, is to connect us to that story, which is life-affirming and meaning-affirming. And when we tell that story, that God is Matzilenu Mi Adam, that there's a rescue and there's a salvation that comes even when you have very serious enemies, that is a transformative knowledge, and we absorb it, and that, constitutes who we are, who we want to be. I think that that's exactly right. But certain words are, it's Manishtana Hashana Hazot. It's like, how different is this year? And it's going to be different. It's got to be.
It'll be different. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well said. Oh,
it's going to be life-affirming as well, as was the Metzora in his, her experience. That person suffering scale disease gets their life back and has a life-affirming experience. And the Seder for us is going to be life-affirming because of the narrative of the eternal Jewish people that tells this story from generation to generation.
Elliot, since you came back to the Metzora,
yes,
we have to end the way we should have begun.
Which is? That
this is an amazing Parsha.
It's an amazing Parsha. And next week, we'll have an amazing Parsha as well. In the meantime, I hope everyone has a good week, quiet week, and a good Shabbat. And we look forward to seeing you in the next week, in the next edition of Parsha Shabbat Shalom.
Boris Tov and Shabbat Shalom.
Boris Tov.
FM.